Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Demonstrate the military utility of the Starlink system. Essentially, we had a mesh network of radios and SOF on the ground. That network then connected to an AC-130 overhead that was connected to the Starlink satellites.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Kodiak Shack podcast. Today, we have Adam Chitwood, and he worked at the Agile Battle Lab. You're going to learn all about that in a little bit, but first, we're going to take care of some admin. Today, we have Bender here as well. Bender and I have had some scheduling issues, so he hasn't been able to make all of them. But thank you, everybody, for donations and for the support of the podcast. Please send us 5-star ratings on wherever you listen to podcasts. And then also send us any topics you want to listen to or hear about, because we're always listening and we want to know what good content you're looking to have. So Adam Chitwood is just about to finish his 20-year career in the Air Force. And he's done a few things. We talked about the Agile Battle Lab. He flew the B-1 initially. He worked in the Indo-Pacific area, which I think I know where that is. And then he also did the Foreign Policy Advisor Fellowship, and I believe, if LinkedIn is correct, he got his MBA at Stanford. So, Adam, thank you for being here. Correct me if I'm wrong with all that, and tell us about yourself. It's not a trap.
But the only that needs some correction is I was a FATE to begin with, T6 FATE, and my MBA is from Florida. I just have a certificate from Stanford.
Yep, that's my fault. That's I didn't read the fine print.
Is that like a cheaper option?
Close enough.
Is that what I should
close
be
enough.
Going for? Is
it, yeah.
You still get the, I get the diploma, the Stanford diploma?
Time. So the UF MBA was awesome. It was the number one online MBA in the nation at the time. And, you know, the Air Force doesn't let people just go to school when they desire. So that's what I went after. But did Stanford Ignite.
Oh, cool.
Last about 14, 15 months ago.
Yeah,
we heard good things.
Awesome. Yeah, we heard... Cindy Brothers.
Cindy.
Yeah, she went there. She also said awesome stuff about it. So the so you did the Stanford Ignite, which sounds cool, and then the MBAs are back. Get ready. Well, I guess masters in general, but specifically the MBA, you know, the masters. But so that's pluses and minuses. That's right.
Check
you got
that
to
box.
The well, actually, before well, we get into
yeah,
all the
you
other
got a
stuff,
real one at least.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
A kind of a
well, and this
real-ish.
Is.
I went looking for a real one. I did not want to check the box, and it has paid, I would say, dividends for me. I definitely had options to do stuff, whether it was stay in or get out. I'm not a check the box kind of guy, but I know that many of the masses are, and that's just the function of the Air Force these days.
One of the things that we've, because a lot of people have strong opinions one way or another about the masters being unmasked, and we've talked about this on previous bro chats, but the overarching thing is it's not you have to have a master's. It's that you can see whether someone has a master's or not. Would you say in your experience in the military, when that was a requirement, because I think it was 2014, they got rid of the, they remasked the masters, if you will. What would you say prior to that to after that? Was it a requirement or was it a, okay, so that was the reality. We here at the Kodiak Shack podcast would like to welcome our new sponsor, Adamus Cyber. Working with the military means there are some minimum cybersecurity requirements that are in every contract. Complying with these requirements can be painfully slow and really take your company's focus off your military customers and end users. Thankfully, the team at Adamus has simplified the process exclusively for small businesses working with the military. It should be expected that security requirements are going to be a part of working with the military, but they don't have to be difficult. Learn why prior guests on the podcast like Arun from OpsLab or Brian from ResCon use Adamus to comply with the NIST 800-171, DFARS 7012, and CMMC cybersecurity requirements in their contracts. Check out their website at www.adamuscyber.com and tell them you heard about them from the Kodiak Shack podcast. Their website will be in the show notes. We appreciate all the companies that want to work with the military, and we understand working with the government isn't always the easiest thing, but we appreciate companies like Adamus that make it just a little bit easier.
My commander said, I cannot promote you if you don't have a master's, period.
And I think that's what everybody's... Yeah, well, good on you.
Well, given poor retention, people will still get promoted, I think. I mean, there's just... You can't not promote people these days. There's no one staying in. But they'll use those box checkers for something else. They'll use it for command or school or who gets to be some general's exec that can then get sponsored or whatever else. So... It's the function of the Air Force these days.
And I think that's what people are afraid of. And I think you're spot on where in 2010 and 11 and 12, promotions were being decided whether someone had a master's or not. But now there's no, I mean, they're talking to people who are 2012 year groups about how they're critically manned and that if you just stay in, you're probably going to take command of a squadron. And it's kind of laughable that now we've got a master's.
Last guy out. Turn the lights off, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Oh man. So either not to devolve into that very much. But so first we'll talk about the B1. So how did you like flying the B1?
I loved it. It going from being a FAPE to that took some adjusting. But after my first deployment, upgrading quickly after that, I just got tired of thinking that we could do better. So I threw myself into it and I loved it. I loved it after that. It's an absolutely deadly aircraft. Can do so much in the right environment. Great community in terms of everyone contributing to the success of the mission. I culminated my B-1 career over Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, 2015-2016. And It was awesome. We did stuff that no one else could. We routinely were the fastest to respond, called on when others weren't. And we just did a lot more because of what we had built in the community, because of the capabilities of the aircraft, and because of the nature of the war. An absolutely tremendous platform over there. Flew with General Brown, New Year's Day of 2016, rain and hate over Ramadi, 10 danger close nine lines, executed. Like that was just a normal day back then. And it was in the right place at the right time. So love the B-1, and it can do a lot more in the Indo-Pacific as well. So, yeah.
Well, and that's – so one thing I want you to explain for me, but also the audience. So what was the B-1 originally built for? Like the mission set that they were like, this is what the B-1's going to do. And then what do you envision the B-1 doing in years to come and in combat that we expect?
So originally designed to penetrate the Soviet Union, low altitude, high speed, and then pop up, drop in either nuclear gravity bombs or cruise missiles type stuff. and then trying to make it somewhere where you can live, you know, the nuclear winter. They were on alert for a long time. They did not fly in Desert Storm, but they came off alert soon thereafter. First combat, I think, was Operation Desert Fox in 98. They also, I think, flew an Allied force, if I get the right Balkans conflict right. Did some great stuff. Evaded a fair share of SA-6s in that, while dropping bombs. It flew combat, you know, in Afghanistan after 9/11. First night of the war, 2003, over Iraq. I joined the community in 2008. First deployment was in 2010. Around the 2003-ish timeline is where they went from dropping DUN bombs to JDAM. So that was definitely a technological advance in the community. And then I got the sniper targeting pod 2009-ish. I deployed with it in 2010 over Afghanistan. Did some great work there. First bomb run supporting Marines in Northwest Afghanistan. And then the targeting pod was integrated sometime 2012-ish. I think I'm really at the limits of my historical knowledge here. And we were also kind of the threshold platform for the JASSM, keeping the JASSM program alive and making it work. Through my efforts into that, as well as hard target defeat, which essentially is using JDAM to dig down deep into wherever you're hiding. Used a lot of that in over Iraq and Syria to great effect. That's why we dropped some of the danger close, because we really knew what we were doing with those bombs. And looking forward to the Indo-Pacific, it can operate from a lot of places, not just Guam. JASSM, LRASM, JDAM, hunting ships can do a lot. It is facing, elimination from the fleet at some point in time in the future. When it will disappear, it depends on who you ask. But I think for the near future, it is the backbone of this. It is the backbone of the strategic bomber fleet, and it will continue to be so until someone knocks off his throne, or it just can't fly anymore.
Yeah, and I think it's really hard. I mean, as we're seeing with the F-15C, the A-10, like the F-16, there's so many planes that they keep saying they want to get rid of, but then they never go away. So I have a feeling whatever the date is, just like, you know, add a handful of years beyond that, it's probably going to keep flying, you know?
Yes.
It's a pretty sick jet. Have you, Vader, ever been up close to one, like sitting on the ground, like a static?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's massive compared to a Viper. So that's awesome. So, but then I thought, like, the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, you know, it's a sick, huge airplane. It'll, you know, you're like climbing up at the cockpit. It's going to be like nice and roomy. They're going to have like a nice bathroom. That thing is freaking, it's probably smaller per individual than the Viper is. Like, honestly, it's crazy. I can't believe you stuffed four dudes into that jet. And the rest of it is just this massive weapons rack, which is awesome. So to like
it is
look
gas
up
and fuel rotor. And gas and fuel. Pardon me. Fuel and bombs. Sorry about that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. I don't know. It's like 30 plus JDAM, right? That you can carry.
24 in internal 2,000 pound class weapons. So 24 GB-31s or JASSM. It'd be nice if we could hang some external racks on that. I don't know where the money people lie on that scale. And a whole lot of gas. I love going low in the Nellis ranges, and then at maneuvering for a Blue Viper, and then outrunning you because I can go down low and fast, and I've got the gas to do so. And then turn pitch right back in to kill the target, which I've done before. It's fun, but yeah, it's big. The horizontal stabilizer is about as big as your Viper wing. So yeah.
I remember when they told me that. The I believe it's 220s, Pratt & Whitney 220s. There's four of them. So they have four F-16 motors or F-15C motors in there, and it is noticeable when one takes off. I think probably surprisingly, the closest I've been to one was when a B-1 was getting gas from a 135, and I was rejoining on the 135, and And what it looked like the 135 was going to like crumple up like a can that got like all the air like taken out of it. And then it was just going to like ding, 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 you know, across the top of the B1. And then we're like, all right, send in another one. But yeah, it's, I mean, it's a large plane and it, I mean, it's sleek. It's meant to move, obviously. It's going to, like, what? I don't know. Maybe I'm saying secrets, but, like, Mach 1.2 on the deck, which is real fast.
A little higher than that. It can't go that fast as low, but it can go as fast as you need to go.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, somebody told me, like, you know, hey, you rejoin on one of those, and they can walk away from you, and you're like, oh, but you're in a fighter. And it's like, well, they have 4 year motors, so, you know, it's just science. Well, that's good. Yeah, I think a lot of what we talk about in the military is it's not the any individual plane, whether it's a Raptor or a C model or 35 or a B1, but it's all of them. It's when they all show up, like that is a bad day for anybody on the opposite side of the line. But that's what you want. Like you want people to be like, holy smokes, this is not good for us, you know?
Yeah. You know, the Army uses the term combined arms, and that's where the Air Force excels, is when you bring them all together. You know, I was talking about Iraq and Syria. We are an amazing CAS platform for a traditional war in an urban environment. It doesn't mean we're the only or best CAS platform out there, nor does it mean I can do everything that an Eagle or Raptor or whatever else can do. But you're right. When you bring the whole family together, when employed correctly, we're going to bring a world of hurt.
Yeah. Is it automatic when the wings will move or how does that work?
All manual.
Nice. Gotta earn that pay. So you said you were at Moody and that was your FAPE tour and then you went to Columbus or how did it work?
So student pilot training at Moody and then Columbus, then FAPE back to Moody. Moody got shut down, had to finish my FAPE tour at Columbus. So I'd seen a lot of the Southeast. And then from there, went to Dyess, stayed there longer than I anticipated. Short tour at Ellsworth, and then off to school, Indo-Pacom, and then here. And that's 20 years.
Yeah. Which, do you feel like it went by quickly now in hindsight?
Long days.
Maybe.
Yeah. Long days, you know that you throw yourself into it. Like you can't shortchange 20 years.
Yeah.
That is my adult life.
Yeah. Well, and Bender and I, we were both Columbus guys. And then we pretty much kind of just traveled around the world together. We both went to Phoenix for F-16s and then we went to Misawa, Japan for our first assignments. But I don't know about you, Bender, but our first assignment in Misawa felt like a blink of an eye. Like in hindsight, I'm like, oh man, it was like no time at all. And real time, it felt like it took forever. But in hindsight, it's like, holy cow, we got to Japan and then we left and somehow 3 years, you know, passed. Was it the same for you, Bender?
Yeah, it feels like, well, it's just like little, small little lives. So Misawa just feels like a distant memory. And then South Carolina feels the same way. Which so, yeah, it feels like it went fast. But now that I have like 5 years left, I'm like, holy crap, can I churn this butter for 5 more years? Like, I'm not sure I can. Like, this is going to take forever.
Well, so, all right, we're going to shift gears now. So obviously this is a defense innovation podcast. So there's a lot of defense innovation going on from the private sector, from the military, from each branch in the military. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Air Force is kind of the biggest spender in these innovation things, but Agile Battle Lab. So how did it get created? And then what is its kind of charge or what's its vector to do?
Yeah, so history of the ABL dates back to essentially New Year's Day of 2019, where it stood up as AETC, Detachment 24, Squadron Next. And the charge there was to design the cross-functional squadron of the future, and then go forth and conquer. And the team there built a cross-functional unit and very quickly started to figure out some stuff to innovate in and find new ways of fighting the war. Within a few months, they'd already put on a few exercises / demos / let's figure it out. And that got briefed to Corona, like that summer of 19, by Jenna Quast to Jenna Holfing. Around that time, I was a speechwriter to the commander of Indo-Pacific Command, so Admiral Davidson. I got a call one morning saying, "Hey, we got this job here. I think it's perfect for you." My buddy described it a little bit, and I was like, "Sounds cool. Sounds high risk, medium reward." But after about a few phone calls, I was like, "Yeah, it's time." So that was summer of 19. Change of command at AETC. New commander comes in and says, "You know, I was at Corona." General Goldfein said, "Awesome work with like the mesh network and radios, et cetera, but that sounds like an ACC job. So time to move this over to ACC." I land from Hawaii in San Antonio about that time. And a week later, we're on the road to an exercise with NORTHCOM with T-6s. So AETC Detachment 24 in that summer fall also picked up the pilot training next mission. So from Detachment 21 at Austin. So now you've got a brand new unit with two very distinct missions. You know, evolve pilot training and evolve the way we fight the next war. And OT&E for that. Organized, train, and equip for that. So that exercise in October of 19, we also had a lot of casual lieutenants waiting to go to, you know, pilot training next. We're also setting up sensor towers from Anduril, running an exercise at Fort Carson. And it was awesome. Outbriefed to the NORTHCOM commander in the middle of a snowstorm, you know, later that week on stuff. And in that time, a lot of you're cleared hot to do whatever you want from AETC, as well as a lot of fundings and manpower, or say support from AFRL's SDPE organization. So I'm going to mess this up, but like strategic development, planning, execution, or something like that. They do cool stuff. So I land, we do that, and I was the director of operations for that side now of the detachment, and told to move to ACC right quick. So after that, we plan to get on a plane, go to ACC, and like we're orphan kids asking to be hired, because I've got to move an organization as directed by the chief of staff of the Air Force, but no one kind of knew that or had seen the direct orders, et cetera. So we go hat in hand talking about what we do as we're getting ready for what became known as ABMS, or the Advanced Battle Management System on ramp number one, which dates back to the Starlink program, and it was called Global Lightning or something. Anyway, AFRL, some really smart future thinking people understood what value Starlink was going to bring to the military. So before I joined the unit, people in what was Squadron X said, "Hey, can we pile into that and do some stuff?" And they said, "Yeah, sure, come on in." So as we were talking to NORTHCOM about what we did, that small experiment with us, AFRL, Starlink, and a few others became this much larger thing, and it blew up in about 30, maybe 60 days of notice for a lot of people just to come on in and bring what you can. Let's talk about cruise missile defense and everything else under the sun. So we were kind of the seed corn for those on-ramps. We were the first unit to demonstrate the military utility of the Starlink system. Essentially, we had a mesh network of radios and SOF on the ground. That network then connected to an AC-130 overhead that was connected to the Starlink satellites, like the first. I don't remember if it was 60 or 120 that were overhead at the time, but the very early days of Starlink. And then we ran essentially geographically separated targeting cells, you know, going up through Starlink and then come back down through the internet to validate that we were doing something of utility with it and with decent, you know, minimal latency, et cetera. And that was ABMS on ramp one, and that succeeded because we had a first lieutenant communications officer that was well ahead of his time, And he was kind of given to us as like a, here, we don't need this guy. You guys can take him. Because he was working like help desk type stuff. But he had a cyber background, a comm background, and he is still one of the smartest engineers, programmers I've met in my 3+ years now in this ecosystem. He's a first lieutenant, just plugging away. And my job at that exercise was essentially to ensure his flow of Monster energy drinks was, you know, there, because when we had to fix something in the middle of the night, he was the one doing it because I was not doing the ones and zeros. But he understood all the systems better than everyone else combined. He made that work. Got a coin from General O'Shaughnessy at the end of it, and that was awesome. So as we're trying to work, transition to ACC, the original plan was, hey, this attachment just does innovation and all that kind of stuff. Don't get bogged down with the queep. In reality, it's we had to get doubled down on the queep, because everything we were doing, we were smaller, we didn't have a process, no one else had a process for it, so we had to learn every AFI, every reg, moving billets, moving bodies, paperwork, what code's this. Like when I joined, when I joined Squadron Next, I was in an evaluator East MC-130 position. Like that's what they had. So that's what that's how we rolled for like the entire time in terms of administrative type stuff. As we moved to ACC, ACC said, hey, we like what you're doing. Or the visionaries within ACC that hired us, we like what you're doing, but we need help with ACE. We're like, well, we were kind of doing this for ACE anyway. I personally had a background in ACE before it was called ACE, dating back to my time in the B1. So that was easy. So new mission, new brand, and we kept on keeping on getting ready for ABMS on ramp 2. COVID hits, that gets rolled a few months, but we still execute. And at ABMS on ramp 2, you see pictures of robot dogs, dudes in VR gear, the LC-130s, all that stuff, Agile Battle Lab, running an ACE airfield with HIMARS, contingency response professionals, and then we even had ground launch cruise missile targeting type stuff on some C2 software that we're using. So it was awesome. Then soon after that, we go to our first Agile flag. So ACC developed exercise for Agile combat employment, and doing all the ABMS on ramps, we thought, hey, we're going to bring in a lot of cool tech. It's going to be awesome. And we go to the first Agile flag, and there's a lot of problems. And we realized that we can't just bring the tech in. There's a whole lot of change that has to happen across the Air Force. I'm not going to get into the details, but essentially we hadn't trained anyone for ACE or even kind of defined what it is for them or how to do it. So there's a lot of awesome airmen from the wing commander on down to Mountain Home trying to figure it out, their first time on their own type of stuff. And that's when we, instead of just bringing cool tech in, started partnering with the wings. Like, hey, we saw these problems. Do you agree the problems? Now let's try and figure it out. The best analogy I could come up with when I explained it was the IG comes in and identifies, weaknesses and flaws. We did the same thing, but we didn't grade you. Our job is to fix it. And we quickly realized that if I saw a flaw in your wing or your organization, it wasn't because you aren't good. It was because you and your counterparts aren't good at something you've never been trained to do. So it was structural across the Air Force type problems. So that's what we started to solve. And we built it not just for the wing we were partnering with, but everyone else was going to affect. At that point in time, I stopped flying too, because I was supposed to be doing, pilot training next and this Agile Battle Lab mission. So I just took myself off the schedule for 6 months, but in reality, I never looked back. So I got flown, sent that last student ride that I flew before the first Agile flight. Around that time, we changed our mission statement to accelerate technology, tactics, and unit design to realize ACE alongside ACC units. And when it comes to innovation, you can't just change one of those things. You're hitting all those levers. You know, it's kind of like, you know, moving the throttles, you know, in your formation. It has a couple of downstream effects. So if you want to bring new tech in, cool, new tactics to employ it, new unit design, new training, new whatever else. Same thing, if you want to change your tactics or your unit design, you probably need some new tech to enable that. The one thing we did not advertise was policy. A lot of stuff requires policy changes, and we just weren't going to pretend that we could influence that significantly. So that was, I guess, fall of 2020. And for the next, you know, few months on the road, a lot of wing exercises, trying to come up with solutions, fielding solutions. We wanted to field a solution, you know, multiple solutions within 12 months. And that was our time frame. And we quickly realized that you can put something cool in the hands of an airman and an exercise, but their desire to fully embrace that new technology or new tactic without the appropriate training, without the appropriate buy-in from everyone, without acknowledging that even if something isn't 100% ready, it's okay and something could fail, that just wasn't going to fly. So you can't just drop new stuff in and say, hey, look, I got a 70% solution for you. It's awesome. So we then began to put on our own events called on-ramps. It was partly at the direction of our leadership in ACC. So this is kind of our second major pivot, which is not only are we going to come up with solutions, but we now have to build an exercise where failure is allowed, where units are allowed to execute the thing that the exercise is focused on without doing all the other stuff. You know, when you build, you know, objectives for your own wing exercise or whatever else, security forces has to have their play. You have to get the right escort or the right, you know, bomb dropping objectives. You got to make all those, you got to add all those ingredients in before you know what you're making. Whereas we were going to build a tailored event specifically for the thing we were making. And if I didn't get certain ingredients in, like, don't care, because we want to focus on that. And we wanted the wing, from the wing commander down to the airman, to tell our leadership what worked and didn't work. So it wasn't us saying, hey, here's this cool piece of knowledge. It was new tactic. You got to buy it and do it. It's here's what we think. We're going to train the airman upon how to use it, do it, et cetera. And that'll let them tell, you know, COMAC or whatever senior civilian is there, what they think of it. So it's not just our PowerPoint arguing with someone else's PowerPoint. It's a true solution that we've proved out in the field. And I say proved out, like, we experimented with stuff. We ran at a speed that we knew we could not ensure success. We were hoping for 75% success if we were lucky, not knowing what was going to succeed or fail. Some stuff, as expected, succeeded quite well. Some stuff we thought was going to be awesome, and it wasn't. And then some stuff we thought wasn't that important became the bee's knees. So that first on-ramp in December of 2021, so a little over a year now ago, we had a lot of collaboration with the chief architect's office because we were focusing on communications and command and control stuff. It's called the C3 Ops Rehearsal. It was essentially, it's not what we wanted to do, but it was like the number one problem of multiple wing commanders. So, you know, our model was to solve the user's problems, whether it was the wing commander or the Indo-PACOM commander. We were going to solve that problem. So they said they had a comm problem, a C2 problem. So we got to go solve that. Even though we had lost our comm officer, you know, long before. So close integration with the chief architect's office, industry, in this case, the 23rd wing, and other wings to test out and experiment with stuff. And it worked fantastically. Like the wing was blown away by how awesome some of the technology was. Some of it we stole from the Marines because, you know, why reinvent the wheel? We found something that worked. Some of it was, like, there's one piece of equipment I'll acknowledge called the FAC, or Flyaway Comm Terminal. That's what we called it eventually. When it was first proposed to us by Commander Shaw, I didn't think it was really that important or worth pursuing. But once again, our job was to, you know, solve the problems of customers. So we did some homework. My superintendent did. And he quickly put together, you know, with industry, these, you know, just the minimum amount of stuff you need to deploy and communicate And that's, it's taken off like gangbusters. And when we fast forward now to that event with General Kelly, the ACC commander, Mr. Preston Dunlop, the chief architect of the Air Force, and others, we got a lot of stuff in front of them with the airmen saying what worked, what didn't work, how useful it was. And a lot of that stuff made it into the POM for funding. So that's like our budgeting process in the Air Force. So for large scale acquisition.
One of the questions I had, not to derail. So how do you move from AETC to ACC and have any sort of funding? Because it seems like a lot of that is difficult to have. And then two, what is the structure that currently exists that doesn't really allow for people to innovate that way? Is it because we have very scripted, very deliberate exercises?
So you asked a few questions there. How do you change commands? You have to enjoy inflicting pain upon yourself. it was not something I'd want to do again. And I'm fine with inflicting pain on myself. That was far too much pain that was required. We actually got shut down a few times because the process was so slow. My DO at the time, fantastic officer, eventually was the DG, probably distinguished graduate of ACSC. One of the times when we were shut down, he was told to run the casual lieutenant program. So it was not just shut down, but it was like, we're shutting you down and we're punishing you for trying something.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
As we moved over, our leadership in ACC A3 essentially gave us a free checkbook to go TDY and to find solutions. And we depend upon a lot of at-fork SIBRs to fund stuff. We got some funding through ACC for our projects, but minor in comparison to, I don't know, your flying hour program that ACC A3 is also in charge of. And we tried real hard to only bring solutions that we knew had a high probability of success. So we weren't just out, you know, writing checks for whatever we could. We put a lot of effort into anything we asked money for. And essentially, we were never told no, but it was because we were being so diligent. And we were always trying to provide value to the customer, to the wing commander, to the user, to someone at HAF or Indo-PACOM who said, yes, this is scratching our itch. So we weren't working for us. It was never about the ABL. The Agile Battle Lab is not going to war. But we wanted to make sure that people who went to war had what they needed. Whether it was education, educating wing commanders on the O plans. So he or she would understand the risk to their forces, to understand why they should be focusing so much on ACE or why they should focus on very specific solutions. Not everything was a technical solution. Sometimes it was your logistics officers need to do X. Your CE officers need to do Y. That require additional tech, just requires, new focus. I think had we had different leadership in ACC, A3, we would have had a much different probability of success. So hats off to Mr. Ichida and the team and the A35 team and ACC A3. Got nothing but good words for them.
And these solutions that you're finding at each of these bases, I assume a lot of this stuff is common across bases, because a lot of times bases have the same discrepancies or deficiencies. Are these
same problems? Yes. Okay. And the solutions we try to build. Now, keep in mind, we are not building a specific widget for your aircraft, which would not work on someone else's aircraft. We spent a lot of time trying to work with AFMC and AFWERX to build an ecosystem where we could build solutions that worked across multiple airframes, but the ability to communicate, let's say, that need exists across all the units. And we built a solution that worked for all of them. And no kidding, we went out to Davis-Monthan to make sure it worked in the A-10 unit, went to Hill, make sure it worked with F-35s, worked with Shaw, make sure it worked with F-16 units, fulfilled their needs of their units and stuff like that. While figuring out all the other ins and outs type of stuff from contracting and every other administrative piece you think you need, we had to do that as well. Authorities to operate and everything else. Yeah.
How much I can't think of a nice way to say it.
Yep. What I call staff 101 is not my job. And yeah. You can get real far with staff 101. You don't want to say not my job, but there's a lot of people who are, really good at making you think it's not their job. Staff 201 is what I call ghosting, where people just hope you ignore them after a while and you lose track of it. We ran with our hair on fire all the time, so it's easy to run into that. There is... Now, this is a problem with our bureaucracy in the Air Force, and primarily on the headquarters staffs. I say staffs, plural. It's across the board. We are very much organized to support our rice bowls, whether it's your career field, your MDS, your job jar, or whatever else. And so many of our problems cross those stovepipes. So when you ask about people that say no or whatever else, we either had to build a coalition of the willing, which was find that one person in that division or career field that would, run alongside you and, take flak, whether it was a sergeant or a colonel. Because even, colonels couldn't just direct their whole career field to change, direction type of stuff. And then we had to continue showing the utility of that with the unit. Like I said, our PowerPoints were never going to compete with someone else's PowerPoints. We just didn't have the mass to overpower someone else's noise and legacy, division, career field, whatever else. So we had to show utility in the field. I started a sprint late last spring, finished off by my replacement, focused on force protection. We did a force protection officer, so focused on primarily camouflage, concealment, and deception. Things talked about a lot, but we actually did it, focused on it. Some stuff succeeded, did great. Some stuff didn't work out as well as we had hoped. But we were running with our hair on fire, trying to get stuff done, because that's the pace you need to move at the speed of relevancy. If you're waiting to be successful, you're way too slow for the size of the threat and the pace of change that we need. And then we always had to get it in front of leadership. You know, a leader seeing something up in his or her face, and understanding, you know, and understanding that this solves a problem that they intimately are familiar with is so much better than PowerPoint, you know, Project X competing against PowerPoint Project Y. Because everyone probably knows what PowerPoint Project Y is. We've been doing it for 40 years, and we just need, you know, more of the same. So if you want to do something different, you've got to prove it out in real life. And that's what we try to do.
Yeah, Bender, you can get the next one. I've been stealing all the questions. But so if a base, so somebody, a military member who's listening to this, or someone who hasn't participated in Agile Battle Lab, like, how do they get into this and start getting to participate in these things if they want their base to do it?
So we execute a lot of outreach. Like I said, I would educate wing commanders down to you know, airmen and stuff like that. So we're connected with a lot of the ACC bases, a few of the AMC bases, as well as a few in PACAC and U Safety. But the Agile Battle Lab is pretty small. So if you want to, and now I'm no longer part of the ABL, so I can't speak for them. But when I was in charge, if you wanted to be a part of it, you had to keep working with us. As soon as, you know, cooperation went cold from someone else, we just didn't have the human bandwidth to keep pushing for something. So if you reached out once or twice, we responded and this or that, like, and that's all. It's not because we didn't like it. It's because we had a lot of pressing needs. You know, two OSS commanders in a row at Hill, you know, reached out to us for help. The first time we couldn't really help out because the larger demand signal was coming from the lead wings for the lead wing, you know, ACE, Agile Flag type stuff. But by the time the second guy reached out, we had something we could work with him on. And it was just, you know, close collaboration throughout. And it wasn't, a lot of it was, I would say, interpersonal, just working with each other. Can't assume that cold emails are going to, you know, generate a giant lottery of wins. But a lot of just working together, putting effort and stuff. In fact, when we start working with a wing on a project, we can't hit the wing commander up for everything. So when we agreed to work on, you know, Project X, it's, hey, I need a POC that I can reach out to whenever I need something, so that they're running this on their end as well. And we're connected to a lot of the, you know, the MAGCOM efforts, as well as HAF, Army Headquarters Air Force efforts. So we're not just working with the wings. We're trying to tie stuff from the smallest tactical level up to the operational and strategic level, you know, and have that line of continuity throughout, so everyone understands what we're doing. We're very open kimono about what we're doing. I mean, we're so small and cross-functional that as soon as you hide something, you're all going to flounder. So we almost had to advertise that we're going to ruffle feathers as much as we could, so that no one was surprised by what we were doing. And we're usually moving much faster than anyone else could keep up with anyway, especially just random stuff like, you know, requests for frequency authorization. You know, we were planning exercises inside of that timeline, which is usually unheard of, but that's just the timeline we had to move in. So.
When I think a lot of things happen shockingly slow in the DoD. I think a lot of people expect stuff to happen faster, and then it's weeks and it's months. And, you know, like I've been a part of multiple conversations where it's like, cool, we're ready to move forward. And it's like, cool, well, yeah, we'll talk in 7 weeks. And you're like, what? Like, can we talk tomorrow? You know, but so it's a little crazy there sometimes. Bender, you got anything? I don't want to keep stealing all the questions.
No, well, I'm going through the process right now. So having met Adam, I got in contact with the ABL for an upcoming exercise that we're doing out to Indo-PACOM. So they're actually working with us a little bit right now. So they've been awesome as far as trying to support. Again, for a reserve wing, which we are, you know, we do stuff 20 years behind with the active duty. As far as like the mindset, like we're back in like 1985. Like we haven't even been to Desert Storm yet in a lot of ways. So being able to work with that organization that hopefully we, you know, they're going to come out and brief and stuff to like, try to like, hey, like this is a new fight. Like you have to understand that things are going to work differently. So I'm excited to kind of see how that goes, but that's kind of the phase that we're in right now. I wanted to ask, so how big, I've only emailed three different people at the ABL right now. So I know that there's at least three people that work there. how big is that? And then how do people, how are you getting your manning there?
So for our duration, we average out at seven people. You know, think about what you can do with seven people. So we, in my change of command, I said, and I stand by the fact that pound for pound, we were the most effective organization in the Air Force. No one did more with less. One senior executive said, you know, we did more for the Air Force on a starving artist budget than some organizations, you know, have all the money in the world and they're barely showing any kind of progress. And that meant a lot. So we had seven. We have been working really hard to try and get billets for military people. We've had far more people interested in working for us and with us than we've actually been able to hire. You know, everyone holds on to their billets like they're gold, even empty billets. Because if they're manned at 80% and you ask for an empty billet, well, now they're manned at 90%. And that looks worse for them. So they want to hold on to their empty billets that is never going to get filled because it makes it look like they're worse on manning. But our leadership did approve essentially eight civilian hires. We've been going through the process for, I don't know, it seems like over a year, just because building a civilian position, it's a lot of work, you know, and we're not going to, the Agile Battle Lab did not think that it was going to innovate the personnel system. So some of those civilian hire positions are open for hire. I'm not tracking the current state of which ones, but we were looking for, you know, very much a cross-functional team. I was the only pilot in the unit, and while I wanted to hire one or two other pilots, it wasn't because they were pilots, it was because they brought something else to the table. Knowing that's really hard to get a pilot billet anywhere. But like my number one billet to hire my entire time in command was someone with contracting or acquisitions experience. That was more important than anything else. Because that's such a complicated bureaucratic process that we just need an expert to do that.
With the
So when you talk about technologies that you guys are pulling in, I assume that the ABL, you know, like if people are, because again, we talked to a lot of companies that, there's my kids you can hear in the background, a lot of companies that are submitting cyber, you know, applications or whatever. And some organizations have more clout with AFWERX. Like, so I imagine ABL, like if ABL is like, hey, we want this, like that probably, you know, that's better than like some whatever captain in some squadron who's like, hey, this is a cool program. Like, could we submit a request? So I guess what I'm getting at is, how does, you guys don't have a lot of bandwidth, like you're saying. So how are people approaching you to be like, hey, ABL, like we got this product we think would be great for XYZ problems? Or are you like,
hey, we lost him. You still hear me, Vader?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay. So I'll
keep it happens all the time.
Did not throw our weight around AFWERX, but we did collaborate with AFWERX essentially our entire time in existence. It ebbed and flowed due to human bandwidth, not anything else. AFWERX is doing an amazing job, and I'm so glad we were able to work with them, and they're growing into an even, you know, better organization day by day. So they're going to be, you know, if the Air Force changes, it's going to be because of AFWERX. We didn't throw our weight around. There were cibers that we got, there were cibers we didn't get. And we just always try to continue working with them to find a solution, solutions that, you know, work for the whole Air Force. And it wasn't just because the ABL wanted something. We always tried to, you know, draw that line back to this is going to scale across the Air Force. So from the AFWERX director on down, in terms of working with companies, some companies reached out to us. Some we reached out to, you know, reading all the submissions, seeing what looked cool. Sometimes people call us, and sometimes their stuff looks cool. Sometimes it's compelling. And sometimes we're like, you know, you say a lot, but let's put it to the field and let's see. And it works or it doesn't. And either way, there's learning that occurs, because there's no way that, you know, your good idea fairy for tech is completely ready for the field, you know, on day one. So we routinely took stuff out of the field knowing it wouldn't be ready, but knowing that it was not going to be, you know, like a single date. It was going to be one of multiple. Take it out, see what works, see what didn't work, get feedback from the airmen, go back, fix it. And some of our, I would say, some of our best successes are because of that.
When you're doing these agile battle labs and you're going, you know, originally going to bases and kind of testing them out, and now kind of creating your own exercises, if you were going to give a grade across all of the aspects of the military, so like high marks in some areas, then, you know, like miserable marks in others, where would you say the Air Force struggles and needs to focus more, and where would you say they are ahead or achieving?
I would say, like you said, all services are excelling in certain areas and failing in certain areas. And I routinely have conversations with people on their services. We're kicking butt here, or we suck here. No, we suck here. And it is what it is. Areas in which we're not doing well in. So, you know, General Brown said, you know, he graded himself a C, you know, for accelerate, change, or lose. So his words, not mine. We are not evolving our force structure for the next fight. We are trying to take a force structure that was not designed for this fight and use it for the next fight. You can only turn an NFL lineman into a prima ballerina so much. You know, Refrigerator Perry is not going to, you know, dance at whatever famous ballet there is. Like, it's just not going to happen. And so much of our Air Force was designed to be that Refrigerator Perry because we had an old operational concept. ACE and our new operational concepts change everything. So if your MDS, your support equipment, your career field was essentially designed 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, guess what? It probably needs some change. Where we are excelling, I would say I've been privileged to work with some absolutely amazing squadron, group, and wing commanders across the CAF and the MAF that understand the problems that they're facing, and they're willing just to go do it. And they've got a lot more on their plates than I ever did. So I love briefing a room full of commanders saying, here's what you should be doing and you're not. And then acknowledging that I don't have a flying program. I don't have a sapper program. I don't have all these other things. I'm not upgrading anybody. So it's easy for me to throw spears at units that aren't doing stuff, but they've got a lot of other stuff on their plate. So I would say our commanders today, I rarely walked away from the engagement with commander thinking that he or she didn't get it. And it's tough to see in some of the Air Force news releases, but there are some commanders out there that are pushing their units to the brink of failure, not because they're trying to break them, but because they're trying to make them succeed in combat. And that is where I would say the Air Force is succeeding.
Well, awesome. Well, that's good to know, because I know I've heard it somewhere. I don't remember where, but they say, you know, people are our most valuable asset, you know, and so having end user operators, but also commanders doing that.
America did not lead the bombing of Japan in 1942. Jimmy Doolittle did. You know, a team of engineers did not put 50 caliber guns on B-25s. Lieutenant General Kenny did. A coalition of the willing did not, you know, run, plan, and lead Operation Volo. You know, Robin Olds and his weapons officer did. So if you want to, and here's where I think the Air Force is having a challenge, we are not finding those people, empowering them, resourcing them, and retaining them. There are leaders in the officer and the senior enlisted ranks who can win us the next war. You give them a spork, and they'll be the Chinese. I've met them. They can do it. But they're not empowered. resourced and retained to do so. And that is, that's something we are having a huge problem with. And it's really rough to watch.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate because the one thing that I think, speaking as a guy who just joined the Air National Guard, is that, you know, the Air Force feels like they're losing people because they're going to the Guard or the Reserves. But hopefully we should also understand that they're still there. They're still, you know, going to be in meetings. They're still going to be a part of the fight, just in a different capacity. So hopefully if those people aren't on the active duty side still, maybe they can participate or provide their inputs from the other side. But hopefully.
There are some people in Fresno that did some awesome stuff for ACE. The Michigan Guard is absolutely killing it. They are singularly focused on figuring out how to fight, win the next fight.
Well, I think one aspect of the Air National Guard specifically is that they don't leave. You know, then like you said, you know, you spend 18 months, 2 years, 2+ years working on something, but then you end up going on to do something else, where the Air National Guard, people are there for 10, 12, 15, 20 years, learning these things. So I know we gotta get rolling real quick. So Adam, thank you very much for being here. And if you're cool with it, we'll have people reach out on LinkedIn and contact you whether they want to learn more about Agile Battle Labs or just pick your brain on the experiences you've had. So thank you very much.
Thank you. This went by way too quickly. I feel like we've got about 2 or 3 more hours of the content.
Well, we'd be happy to have you back because we have plenty more questions on all of it. But yeah, thank you. Bender, you got any parting shots before we go?
No, we'll have you back because there are a lot of fighter pilots that listen to this who have, anyway, that's the frustration. Right? They know that's stuff they need and there's just no way to get it. And so they would love to pick your brain and kind of see how do we get around.
I think
walls.
As Adam said earlier, like, don't take no for an answer. You know, Slander said it a while ago too. Like, don't let someone who can't tell you yes tell you no, because I think that happens way too much.
If you don't have to, don't ask for permission. Just do it. They're not really going to fire you. How many people do you know have gone to jail or have gotten fired or whatever else? You can continue to be a yes man and get promoted and wait to take a lot of missiles in the face if we go to war. Like, I am not difficult and I don't ruffle feathers in the Air Force because I just like to be a jerk. It's because I truly think we're here for a reason and it's not for CBTs on Tuesdays. It's to go to war, and this next one, it's going to be ugly. So let's get it done while we can.
I think some people forget that sometimes. I think it's been so long that I think people forget that that is the end state reality, and makes me nervous. But all right, thanks again, Adam. And admin, please give us 5 stars, give us ratings, reach out at info@kodiakshack.com. Check out our website, kodiakshack.com, and on YouTube, LinkedIn, all those places, Instagram, we're all over the place, same name everywhere. And let us know what you want to hear about. Let us know if you want to hear more from Adam Chitlin. Thanks again.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Thank you. Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards. Save